If someone wants to kill you, maybe the first thing to do is to find out why. Get to know him, even talk to him. For more than a decade, anthropologist Scott Atran has done just that. He's traveled around the world interviewing Islamic terrorists. He's talked with suicide bombers in prison and with jihadist leaders in training camps. His work is dangerous and revealing. He writes about it in a book called Talking to the Enemy. Atran tells Anne Strangechamps about a trip he took recently to the Indonesian island of Sulawesi, home to 40 different jihadi groups, in the company of a terrorist.
I go up there with a guy named Farhin bin Ahmed. He was the guy who helped blow up the Philippines ambassador house. He was asked to recruit the suicide bombers for the Bali bombing. He had hosted Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the 9/11 mastermind, at his home in Jakarta. And strange time, you know, that we meet a lot of jihadi commanders, and they say, what are you, crazy going up there? They're going to kill you. You know, you're a white guy. We kill whites. I said, that's nice to know. And so Farhin says, okay, you can sit between me and another guy, and we'll protect you. Sort of crazy. We become very good friends, and we laugh and joke together, and both of us in our halting Arabic. We're repairing tires together. Anyway.
So basically, you're bonding with a terrorist killer.
We're bonding. Yeah, he is a killer. He was a killer. I mean, one of the things that struck me about Farhin, so we come across the 17-year-old kid who's just been killed in a skirmish. And tears come into Farhin's eyes. And I say, Farhin, you knew this boy? And he says, no. He goes, I've been fighting since 1980s, and I don't get to be a martyr. He's got 6 kids, 2 wives, loves them. And he's crying because this 17-year-old is dead. This is the first thing I say to myself, man, we've bonded, we're friends, we know one another, yet this is a step I personally cannot make. I can't understand what the hell's going on here. And then the second incident is we come back from Tenteni and we pass a Balinese wedding. Now, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful Hindu wedding. It's colorful. It's scents. And I say to him, we're standing on a balcony. I say, isn't that beautiful? And he looks at me with these sort of cold, glassy eyes and says, I swear to you, if I had a bomb now, I would go down and blow this up. I said, you're kidding, Farhin, right? He looks at me and goes, no, I would do it. I say, why? He says, look at them. They're animals. Look at the way they're behaving. We will never have a country, an honorable country, if this kind of behavior goes on.
So here's the interesting thing. He's saying this to you, a white person, and he's bonded with you and he's friends with you, clearly doesn't want to kill you. So it's the difference between two individuals versus the group.
Absolutely. You know, I interviewed this Christian priest, and he's a very interesting guy because he's the priest to the opposing side. He got thrown into jail with the head of the Jamaa Islamiya, also with Samudra, who was the master bomber for the Bali bombing. And he bonded with them in jail.
But don't the jihadis want to kill the Christian priest?
Well, this is the complexity of jihad. It's not so simple. So, you know, I interviewed Abu Bakr Bashir in prison. I asked him about the priest, Father Damanik, and he says, yes, he's my friend. I couldn't go to his funeral if he died because it would be a Christian funeral. But I want to make sure he's okay, and if he's ever sick, me and my wife will help him. And then Imam Samudra, the guy who was eventually shot, executed for the Bali bombing, he would say, him and Damanik would have these conversations where Damanik would say, you know, you shouldn't have killed all those people. I mean, there were some innocent people there. And he said, well, we had to change things. We had to change this world, this government. And Damanik said, well, there are other ways to do it. Let me give you some ideas. And then Samudri, either jokingly or not, said, well, if I would have met you before, maybe I wouldn't have blown up these people.
So you've interviewed all these guys. Are there any commonalities?
If you look at who joins the jihad, it's almost a random process. It's almost always through friends. It's people at a certain stage in their lives, usually young men, trying to find, as young men do everywhere, significance and adventure and glory in life. I mean, glory, physical adventure and glory are very important. Hamburg guys are a good example, so they had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. They didn't even basically know about it. What they were doing was they were sort of living in the students. They were the only Middle Easterners around, so they didn't belong in the Moroccan group. They didn't belong in the Turkish group, which is the overwhelming Muslim group. They didn't belong among the Germans, so they started schmoozing among themselves. And at that time, Chechnya and Bosnia were sort of this the aftermath of the great glorious Soviet-Afghan War. And they wanted to be glorious and adventurous too. And so they bonded, and there was Mohammed Atta. He was sort of sexually frustrated, and he was a morose guy. And then there was the very sort of liberated Marwan Shehi. He was an open guy, humorous. And then there was Ramzi bin al-Shib, who was the real facilitator. He's a backslapper. I mean, you look at the videos. And then they get an apartment together. And they live in this parallel, this cocoon. And they're imitating the Prophet here. They're withdrawing from Mecca to Medina to regather their forces and to come out. Once they come out of the cocoon, they're going to do their thing. They come out of their cocoon. They don't know what to do. So first they're going to go to Chechnya. And then someone tells them, well, the Russians aren't about to let you in, so change your plans. And I say, okay, we'll go to Bosnia. And the Bosnians tell them, guys, forget it. You don't know, you know, how to handle a rifle. So why don't you get us some night goggles? That'll do it. So they said, well, that's not going to satisfy their glory. So they met this guy on a train. And Ramzi bin al-Shib, in his debriefing to the German police, says, why did I meet him? He had a beard like I had a beard. And so they start talking to one another, and they say, well, look, I know this guy, and maybe he can help you get to Pakistan. And then you see, maybe you go to Chechnya from there. We'll see what you do. I said, okay, so the buddies go, the four of them, they decide to go, and they wound up in Pakistan. They get a bus ticket. They go to Kandahar. And basically, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who had just submitted his plan and had been accepted by Al-Qaeda, says, my God, boss, look what we got. We got these guys with European visas. Okay, let's use them. And that's how the 9/11 plot happened.
But you make this sound like an episode of the Keystone Cops, that it's just all, you know, happenstance and bumbling kids falling over each other.
It almost always fails, but sometimes they get lucky. And I just can't get it that the American government, or even, to tell you the truth, the American people, generally, have been interested at all in who these guys are. What moves them? You know, they're talked about as either psychopaths or cowards. They're normal people who follow a career mostly through friends and family and fellow travelers, like anyone gets into a network. Why do they do it? How to get them out of it? You know, I'm in the White House. I'm, you know, briefing the National Security Council staff. A young woman from Mr. Cheney's office comes up and says, you know, don't these young people understand that they have to take individual responsibility, or we're going to bomb them and we're going to kill them? I say, you know, what are you kidding? You're going to bomb London? You're going to bomb Morocco? It's our ally. You got to figure out something else to do with these young people, especially the future generation. You can't just figure you're going to bomb them. So what are your plans to do? They have no plan. And let me just give you this example. So the five of the seven Madrid bombers who blew themselves up after the Madrid bombings, I said, grew up in the same neighborhood within 200 meters of one another. They went to the same elementary school where you see Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck, no Quran there. So I went to the school, really rundown neighborhood, and I asked the kids playing in the garbage soccer. They're playing in the garbage soccer. I asked the first kid, he's 8 years old, what do you want to be? He goes, I want to be an archaeologist. I say, what? You want to find treasure? He goes, no, I want to find out who we are. Wow. I asked the next kid, he says, I want to be a doctor. I want to save people. And then I say, who are your heroes? First hero is Ronaldinho. He's a soccer star, you know. Second hero was the Terminator. He's an action hero, right? They have no idea he's related to the then governor of California. And the third hero was Osama bin Laden. And then I went back after Barack Obama's election, and I asked the same question. First hero was soccer player Sergio Morales, who was the striker for Real Madrid. Second was Terminator 2. Third was Barack Obama. Fourth was Osama bin Laden. So I'm going, what is this telling us? It's telling us that these kids are looking for something in life. They're looking around the world and see these roles, these heroes. They don't know which way to go. They see this guy, this black guy, okay, from out of nowhere becomes head of the most powerful country in the history of the world. And they say, man, maybe there's something there. They see Osama bin Laden, who took kids with four box cutters, young men with four box cutters, changed the history of the world, okay? And so they're weighing these possibilities for heroic, adventurous, glorious action. And what's the United States' response to this? There's no attempt to engage them.
But what do you do instead?
Look at what's happening. Look at the revolution, spontaneous, the Youth Revolutionary Councils of Yemen, for example. in southern Yemen, where al-Qaeda is. What are they saying? They write a letter on July 4th, you know, a 10-page letter to Barack Obama. I doubt Barack Obama's ever read it or people even know about it, saying, "Dear Barack Obama, we love the Declaration of Independence. We love the Constitution. We love life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and we want to add freedom of dreams and dignity. Will you help us achieve that instead of giving money to this corrupt president?" And what's the United States reaction? Gates, the defense secretary, gets on television and says, "Well, I don't know. I mean, we should think twice about letting Saleh go. He's been helpful to us in fighting al-Qaeda, while there are millions of people on the streets who can't stand this brutal dictator, and we're hedging and hawing."
You know, you end your book with a quotation from Abraham Lincoln. I think it pretty much sums up the direction you suggest we go. You want to talk about it?
You know, there are really only two ways to win a war like this, or win any war. You either exterminate your enemies, or you think about it the way Abraham Lincoln thought about it at the last stages of the Civil War, when he made a speech talking about the Southern rebels as people just like anybody else. And an elderly woman, a staunch unionist, upbraided the president for speaking kindly of his enemies when he should be thinking of destroying them. And he said, "Madam, do I not destroy my enemies when I make them my friends? And how are we going to do that? How are we going to do it in this world?"
Scott Atran is an anthropologist at the Centre National de la Recherche Scientifique in Paris and at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in the U.S. His most recent book is Talking to the Enemy: Violent Extremism, Sacred Values, and What It Means to be Human.